For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, Roz Watkins explores the dark side of the Peak District in her new detective thriller, Dead Man's Daughter.
I spend a lot of time walking the dog, and I always kind of think it is perfect for killing people, really, because you've got caves and cliffs, deep quarries, sort of lakes in the quarries that you could hide bodies in.
Robert Kirkwood meets the man who provides audio description for the Game of Thrones TV series.
You've got lots and lots of shouts and noises, and you have to sort of work out, you know, what is essential, who's talking, and whether you can fit stuff into tiny little spaces.
N.B. Dixon reviews a medieval fantasy that's become her book of the year so far. And John McGregor discusses his haunting novel, Reservoir 13. That's all coming up on Read On. Roz Watkins is a rising star in crime fiction. Her first novel, The Devil's Dice, was shortlisted for the Crime Writers Association's Debut Dagger Award last year. It introduced D.I. Meg Dalton, a detective quietly different from any other in contemporary fiction.
I accelerated up the lane, tyres skidding in the mud, and prayed to the gods of murder investigations. Please bestow upon me the competence to act like a proper detective and not screw up in my new job. The gods were silent, but my boss's voice boomed from the hands-free phone. Meg, did you get the details? Body in a cave. Almond smell. Philosophy book. I squinted at the phone, as if that would help. Richard's monologue style of conversation meant he hadn't noticed the bad signal. Had he really said philosophy? Our usual deaths were chaotic and drunken, with absolutely no philosophy involved. Another snatch of Richard's voice. Scratches on his face. Then the line went dead.
Caro Clark narrating The Devil's Dice by Roz Watkins, which is TB702618. The second book in the series, Dead Man's Daughter, has just been published. And thanks to an agreement with HarperCollins, it too is in the RNIB library. It's an equally gripping blend of superstition and suspense, set against the dramatic landscape of the Peak District, from whence Roz Watkins travelled to join me in the RNIB Connect Radio studios in London. Roz Watkins, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
Dead Man's Daughter certainly gets off to a sprint start. Literally, Meg Dalton is chasing after a girl she believes might be in trouble. Could you just tell us a bit about the plot?
Yeah, so it starts when Meg Dalton gets called to a case where somebody's spotted a young girl, sort of 10-year-old girl, running through some woods, and she seems to be covered in blood, so it all sounds quite worrying. Meg goes out there and she sort of ends up going through the trees trying to find this girl. And the girl's running towards a gorge, so at one point it looks like she might even fall into the gorge, which is famous for people dying there. But it turns out she finds the girl, and the girl is absolutely fine, but she is covered in blood. So Meg's trying to work out whose blood it is, whether she's running from someone, and basically what on earth is going on, because it's very strange.
It's wonderfully macabre and really brings out quite how beautifully threatening that part of Derbyshire is. Derbyshire is a character in and of itself in both your books. You have a very strong sense of place.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I do live in the area where I set the books, and I spend a lot of time walking the dog, and I always kind of think it is perfect for killing people, really, because you've got caves and cliffs, deep quarries, sort of lakes in the quarries that you could hide bodies in, and lots of creepy bits of stone everywhere, and yeah, just lots of sort of old myths and legends as well, which get your mind going. So it's, yeah, it's a perfect place really to write crime.
And Meg has come from rough, tough Manchester, where we all, a bit like London, associate gang violence and so on and so forth, and yet that setting in Derbyshire is every bit as threatening and spooky.
Yeah, I think one of the problems for Meg is she's quite scientific, and, you know, she did a science degree originally, and she always wants there to be a rational explanation for everything. So it's quite hard for her when she gets confronted with things that don't seem to make sense. So in the first book, there are various deaths, and it seems that they've been predicted by a witch's curse from centuries ago, which is just mad. And then in the second book, it seems as if this little girl is actually remembering things that happened to her. She's had a heart transplant, and she seems to have changed since the heart transplant. And Meg just thinks this can't really be possible, but as she gets more and more into the case, it seems that it really is. So I quite like torturing her in that way, really. It's quite fun.
Well, I love the way that you bring to the fore that internet conspiracy theories are just the new folklore. Hmm. We fill the spaces that we don't understand with speculation and superstition, whether that's tales around a campfire during the 15th century witch hunts, or swapping gossip on internet chat rooms about whether a donor heart can bring the personality of the donor with it. It's the same thing.
Yeah, and people just love that stuff, don't they? I mean, it's just so intriguing, something that is a bit weird, doesn't make sense, a bit creepy. So I'm quite interested in the way that the internet has taken over the spreading of those sorts of things. And, you know, there's lots of some quite worrying stuff going on, obviously, with young people, and, you know, even these sort of suicide things that go around and encouraging people to do just mad things. It seems like it's a bit too easy to put something on the internet, and then almost the more sort of mad it is, the more likely it is to spread.
Meg is a very grounded person. She's very authentic, I think. I love the way that she is hamstrung by some of the stuff that has happened in her life. She's got an ankle that never mended properly. She's got post-traumatic stress disorder, and yet she is a positive person. She focuses on what she can achieve, as does her best friend, Hannah, who's in a wheelchair. And there's a real sense of normal people have chunks knocked out of them and bumps and bruises and scratches. And normal people are not afraid of discussing disability, gender politics, and how you can be held back in your career because of those things. It's clearly something that you feel very strongly about.
There is a lot of me in Meg, but she has had a much more difficult childhood than I had. I mean, I had quite a sort of boringly nice childhood, really. But I did go through a phase where I had a lot of accidents, and I had one accident where I very nearly broke my neck, and I ended up smashing up both arms really badly and smashing up my face very badly, and was sort of, well, still got a bit of a scar, but it was, you know, it was quite serious. I was in hospital for a little while, and it did make me think, oh, what if I had broken my neck, and sort of how would that have been? And so I guess I've always been quite interested. I really wanted a character like Hannah. I also wanted, I mean, in the first book we do talk about the issue of assisted dying, in particular in relation to Meg's grandmother, and I sort of wanted a disabled person's perspective on that, really, because I've got my views on that, but I think that disabled people really need a voice, especially the way things have gone politically since I wrote the first book, really. It's just got worse and worse, and I can almost imagine the current government thinking, oh yeah, it's much cheaper to just let people kill themselves than it is to give them proper care. And so I really wanted that perspective in the books, and Hannah was sort of able to bring that out, really. You know, her and Meg do have some disagreements, but I hope they're both respectful of each other's opinions.
Well, that's right. It's not a shrill debate. It's a debate between friends about the pros and cons and dignity and how other people might view a loss of independence. Now, I thought it worked very well. And it's a degree of ethics that we don't necessarily tend to find in fiction. Have you had much feedback from other readers about it?
People seem to like it, generally. I mean, I've had mainly really good feedback and people saying they appreciate there's a bit more depth, perhaps, than there often is in a crime book, because it's very much pitched as sort of police procedural crime. So people aren't necessarily expecting that. I do get the odd person in America more than England who really doesn't like Meg. The people who support Trump and are anti-abortion and anti-euthanasia but like guns, those sort of people, Meg specifically has a go at them in the book. So if one of them accidentally reads it, they're not impressed. But that's not really a problem. You know, my editor's sort of fine about people not liking the book. What they don't want is people to be just indifferent. They don't like the 3-star reviews, you know, the sort of, well, it was okay. And we've not had much of that. We tend to get either sort of 5 stars and then a few 1 stars, basically, from the people who just disagree with everything Meg stands for.
I've always felt that the best detective fiction reflects the society that we live in and asks questions, both ethical and sociological. And it's nice to see a new generation of crime writers coming through and not being afraid to stick their heads up above the parapet and to have very authentic characters who you could believe are actually in the Derbyshire Police Force. I take it these are the first 2 books in a series that you've got planned?
Yeah, so the 3rd one is almost finished, and that one again tackles a subject which I feel strongly about, so that's really about the meat industry, but again set in it's a slightly different part of Derbyshire, so it's set near Lady Bower Reservoir, which was created about 70 years ago, and they had to drown a village, two villages actually, to create the reservoir. So I thought that was quite an intriguing idea, these drowned villages, and it's set in a very hot summer when the drowned villages start appearing again. And weirdly, I'd written most of it before last summer, and then it all started coming true. We had a really hot summer and I was able to actually see the drowned village, actually walk on the drowned village. That was, yeah, really interesting. But again, it's got the sort of something that appears a bit supernatural and Meg's got to work out whether it is or probably not. But then it allows me to delve into the sort of ethics of factory farming, which whilst trying not to be preachy, I hope it's very much part of the story. It's another, hopefully, thing that might get people wondering where they are, where they stand on it.
You hopefully will have Caro Clark reading the 3rd novel as well. You really seem to have hit the jackpot as far as having her as a narrator.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, she's brilliant, and I was going to meet her actually, because I was going to come down and sit in on the last afternoon of the recording, book 2, but they finished early, which is kind of really unusual. So unfortunately, I didn't get the chance to do that, but I definitely will for book 3, because it'd be really nice to meet her.
And it's important for you that your books are made accessible to people who can't read print. I believe your grandfather was blind.
Yes, he developed macular degeneration. I suppose he would have probably been in his 70s or 80s when it started. This was 25 years ago, so there wasn't the sort of, you know, that he didn't have the audio books and things that, in quite the same way that you do now. And reading had always been very important to him. So it was tough for him, but he was a very positive person, and he sort of handled it in his own way. I like the fact that the books are made into audiobooks and are available. I think that's brilliant.
And part of the way your grandfather handled it, I believe, was to go out and do some gardening.
He did. I mean, one of the things I remember, he was always a keen gardener anyway. I distinctly remember the lawn mowing, because as his sight was going, he got these huge white sort of square placards, and he'd put a white square at the end of the lawn. He'd have one at each end of the lawn. It was quite a big lawn. And then he'd mow just sort of towards the white thing, and then he'd move it along a precise amount, and then mow back to the one at the other end, and then he'd move that along a precise amount. So it was all very sort of regimented, and he'd end up with this amazing, perfect striped lawn, you know, far better than anything that I've ever created. And it was really impressive. And he still did his potatoes as well. He had a system of sort of strings and ropes and things that he followed to make sure he got all his potatoes in the right places. So it was pretty impressive.
Oh, very resourceful. Any chance that he might surface in part of a blind character in a future book?
Yeah, he might well, actually. That's quite a good idea. I'm always looking for new characters, and I have mined my own family to an extent. So, yeah, I could see him as a character, definitely.
Well, I, for one, will be looking out and looking forward to spotting him popping up in a future book. Could you just let us know what the next book's going to be called and when we can expect it?
Well, that's a very good question. You can expect it in June next year. We're talking about titles at the moment, so I'm not sure what it's going to be called yet. We had some ideas, but the sales team have said that they're not right. We can't have the word blood, apparently. It's not a good selling point. So, yeah, title yet to be revealed.
Meanwhile, for anybody who hasn't read your books, The Devil's Dice and Dead Man's Daughter are both in the RNIB library, and I can't recommend them enough. Ros Watkins, thank you so much for coming in and being a guest on Read On.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Branches rattled above us. Something flickered in the corner of my eye, shining pale in the distance. My breath stopped in my throat, and I felt a twitch of anxiety. "Is there a house in these woods?" I asked. "Approach down a lane." Elaine walked a few steps before answering. "Yes, Bellhurst House." I knew that place. The woman who lived there had kept calling the police, saying she was being watched and followed, but she'd had nothing concrete to report. After the first time, they joked that she had an overactive imagination, possibly a fondness for men in uniform, and we hadn't taken her seriously. Elaine touched my arm. "Did you see the girl?" We waited, eyes wide and ears straining. The dog let out a little affronted half-bark, more of a puff of the cheeks. A twig snapped and something white slipped through the trees. "That's her!" Elaine shouted. "Hurry! The gorge is over there! Children have fallen!" I re-ran in my mind the control room's leisurely reaction to this call. Our previous lacklustre responses to the woman in the house in these woods. A band of worry tightened around my chest. I pictured a little girl crashing over the side of the gorge into the frothing stream below, covered in blood, fleeing something. Something we'd been told about, but dismissed.
Caro Clark narrating Dead Man's Daughter, which is TB704217. And Ros Watkins will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, we explore another moorland mystery as John McGregor discusses his novel Reservoir 13 and N.B. Dixon introduces us to The Ember Knife, a medieval fantasy. But first, and with medieval fantasy in mind, many best-selling books find themselves dramatised for the big or small screen. And if you've enjoyed the book, it's quite natural to want to see how the screenwriters have adapted it. However, blind and partially sighted viewers can find out that they're missing out on a lot of the action, unless it's being audio-described. But how do you audio-describe a series as action-packed as Game of Thrones? Robert Kirkwood spoke to the man whose job it is.
George R.R. Martin's best-selling book series, A Song of Ice and Fire, was first brought to the screen by HBO in April of 2011, as they sunk their considerable storytelling teeth into the medieval fantasy epic. A depiction of powerful families, kings and queens, knights, renegades, liars and honest men, playing a deadly game for control of the Seven Kingdoms of Westeros and to sit atop the Iron Throne. And doing all this under the constant shadow of a threat from the north. The show is shot in Northern Ireland, Malta, Croatia and Spain. And with massive battles and even bigger dragons, it's a very visual show. How does that translate to a blind and partially sighted viewer? Well, this man might have the answer.
Hello, my name is Neville Watchhurst. I audio describe Game of Thrones for Sky TV. The job of the audio describer is to strive to weave clear, concise and timely spoken information around the existing soundtrack in such a way that it doesn't jar with the dialogue, the sound effects and, you know, as far as possible, the musical score, in order to enable blind and partially sighted viewers to more easily follow and more fully enjoy a programme or movie. There's never enough time to describe everything, so it's a constant matter of prioritising and compromising, which inevitably means we can't please all of the people all of the time, but you try to get the essential information across.
Now, when did you start working with Sky?
I started about 17 years ago. Yeah, coming up 17 years ago. So it was quite by chance. I was working, doing some educational tapes, and a chap I was working with, who had the lovely name of Marston York, was doing AD at Sky and said, oh, you ought to drop them a line. So I did, and, you know, the rest is history.
And what sort of things have you worked on in the past?
Well, we start off with the very sort of simple kind of little travel programmes and stuff that's not, and game shows and what have you, that are not terribly taxing, and then sort of built up to drama and movies. So I suppose I've been doing movies for about probably 11 years now. But yeah, bit of everything really, but mainly drama.
Now tell us how it works normally. We know Game of Thrones is a bit different, but tell us how it usually works.
Well, normally, freelance audio describers who work for Sky work from home for the scripting side of it. So we will be sent via, you know, some electronic means, we'll be sent the footage, and we work at home going through it bit by bit slowly to find, basically what you're looking for is a little window, what's known as a cue, which might be sometimes as short as 1 second, or it may, you know, go on for what feels like forever, although you have to be careful not to make them too long, because if you fluff when you're in the studio, then you've got to go back and do the whole thing again. So you sort of then get your script, which is kind of on a standard grid, if you like, with the in code and the out code in the left-hand column, which is, i.e., when you go live and when you stop, and the dialogue that you want to put into that, the description that you want to put into that little space in the other column.
And you then take that script to Sky to record?
Yes, indeed, yeah. So I travel one side of London to the other. I live in Walthamstow, and I travel over to Gillette Corner near Isleworth. And then, you know, you will be booked into a studio for, say, 2 hours, 3 hours, or whatever it will take to get the programme or film done.
But Game of Thrones is so sensitive.
Oh, yes. Yes, it's very much like we've all signed the Official Secrets Act, and HBO had to okay the circumstances under which it would be seen, you know, the booth in which it was going to be recorded and so on. And, for example, last Saturday with episode 3, it wasn't actually delivered to Sky till 7 in the morning, I think. So I arrived at 10 and it was just about finished with the processes that it had to go through. So I started at 10 o'clock and I finished very late that evening.
Yeah, because I was reading in the blog you wrote a couple of weeks ago, I'm just hoping for not too many extended battles per episode. That episode was one big long battle.
It was 77 minutes of battle. And as you can imagine, you've got lots and lots of shouts and noises, and you have to sort of work out, you know, what is essential, who's talking, and whether you can fit stuff into tiny little spaces. And also, as you know, you've probably been reading in the press, it was very dark as well, because they've endeavoured to shoot it in as far as possible in natural light, a bit like Wolf Hall with the candlelight. So it was very dark, so a lot of the time I was struggling to see who was doing what to whom in the shadows.
And it's quite a comparison between episodes 2 and 3. Episode 2 must have been very dialogue heavy. It was quite a slow episode.
Yeah, Yeah, it was. Yes, I could tell though that it wasn't going to last. You know, I knew I was in for a bruising, and last Saturday was quite took it out of me.
Now, we won't give out any spoilers, even though the episode has been aired. But in Game of Thrones and in other things that you've described, there will be big moments, big reveals. How do you cope with that as an audio describer? Do you raise your voice up, or do you try and keep neutral through it all?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there's a kind of school of thought, or at least certainly I think when audio description was in its infancy, that the voice should be very, very deadpan. And I don't quite buy that myself. And I tend to try and, obviously you don't want to be sort of laughing heartily because it's a comedy or weeping because it's a tragedy, but to somehow subtly reflect the tone of what's going on in your voice, I think is appropriate, I hope.
So you're trying to make your audio description as surprising as some of the visuals may be?
Yeah, I suppose so. Yes. You know, rather than just sort of droning on and sort of like nothing's happening of significance. Yeah, I think reflecting the emotion that the broadcast is attempting to trying to bring out in the viewer.
Now, when did you start with Game of Thrones?
I started with series 4, so I will have done the 5 out of the 8. I'm not quite sure who did the previous 3, or how the job fell vacant. but I was very chuffed to get it, and I've been greatly enjoying it for the past few years.
It must be quite good seeing it before everyone else.
Well, it's you get a bit of a tingle. Yeah, it's kind of like, oh yes, I'm one of the only people in the country who knows this. And there's a kind of, obviously there's a danger point between from when I finish on a Saturday till when it gets broadcast in the early hours of Monday. You know. In that time, you know, I could let the cat out of the bag, but I don't, obviously.
Or head to the bookies.
Oh gosh, I haven't done that. I'm so innocent.
Now, at the time of recording this, we've had 3 episodes, and we've got 3 episodes to go.
That's right. Yes. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what's resolved. There's obviously quite a few things up in the air, see how it goes, but I wouldn't mind betting there'll be another battle, but hopefully not a 77-minute one.
If you already have Sky TV, using any Sky Q remote, press home, select settings, select accessibility, then audio description, and change the setting from off to on. For more information, you can head to rnib.org.uk and search for audio description, or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and to Neville Watchhurst. And don't forget that if you'd like to read the books that Game of Thrones is based on, they're all available from the RNIB library in a full range of accessible formats. You can do so by searching for George R.R. Martin on the rniblibrary.com website or calling the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
RNIB Library has the largest library of its kind in Europe, with over 60,000 items in the collection. You choose the books, you choose the format, and we deliver to you. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, we'll explore Reservoir 13 with its author John McGregor, and Ros Watkins will share the books of her life. But before that, here at Read On, we love to hear about the books that you're reading, whether they're new titles or old favourites. You can email us via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk, which is exactly what author and old friend of the show, N.B. Dixon, did. Here she is with another hidden gem.
Hi, this is N.B. Dixon with my review of the book The Ember Blade by Chris Wooding.
Once, his people had been great. They'd led the world in art, theatre, medicine, architecture, philosophy, astronomy, and the ways of war. Their empire had spanned the known lands, and Ossia had been the home of heroes. But that was the past, and the past was long behind them. Their empire had faded centuries before. Ossia had been under a Crodan boot for 30 years now, longer than Edric had been alive. He'd never known true freedom, and so, in the end, he'd gone searching for it.
This is a fantasy book. It's about two neighbouring countries, one of which has conquered the other, so they are fictional countries, although the world is very similar to our own medieval England. So the idea of the story, as probably you might guess, is that there are people in the occupied country who want their freedom, and they are determined to shake off those oppressing them. So maybe not particularly original. A lot of fantasy books are like that, but then there are very few ideas these days, I think, that are completely original. It's the twist you put on them that matters. And in this case, the characters are just absolutely fantastic. Considering it's a fantasy book, there's not actually that much sort of magic going on in there. You've got only one person with any kind of gift, and there are a couple of mystical creatures, but really the book is centred on what oppression does to people, what it brings out in them, the good and the bad. Sounds quite deep and philosophical, I know, but it wasn't. It was just an amazing book. Like I say, you've got a group of characters who in their own different ways rebel against the people oppressing them. And the object of the book is to recover the symbol of their country, which their enemies took and hid from them. And that's pretty much a summary of The Ember Blade, but it really doesn't do the book justice. It's just an absolutely brilliant story, one I couldn't put down. And it's the best book I've read so far this year, I think. Sadly, it's not available from RNIB, which is a bit odd because at the end of the book, in the closing credits, it says it was produced for the RNIB. So, fingers crossed, it will join the library at some point, but it is well worth spending an Audible credit on.
The collapse of the Salt Fork uprising and the long and frantic night that followed had shaken his faith. He'd cursed himself over and over for staking his life on a naive dream of revolution. Yet here, before this silent monument, he found new strength. The blood of its builders still ran in his veins, and one day his people would cast off their chains. "On your feet!" He hauled Dirk back up, though the man was a dead weight.
"Leave me to the worms," he wheezed. "The red-eyed child comes for me."
Edric pointed to the temple, where a dark doorway gaped amid a tangle of vines. "If we must die, it will be with the Nine at our backs, in the house of our ancestors."
"The Nine," Dirk said bitterly. "Where are they now?"
The Ember Blade, Book 1 in the Darkwater Legacy series by Chris Wooding, is out now wherever you buy your books. The audio version is narrated by Simon Bubb. Thanks as always to N.B. Dixon. Earl of Huntingdon, the concluding volume of her Outlaw's Legacy series, is out now in print and ebook. Do you have a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the RNIB library? Why not drop us a line via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Now, before we return to Ros Watkins to discover the books of her life, let's hear from another author inspired by the rugged, elemental landscape of the Peak District. John McGregor is one of the most acclaimed writers of novels and short stories in the UK. All four of his novels to date have been in contention for major literary prizes. Most recently, Reservoir 13, which won the 2017 Costa Novel of the Year Award. It tells the story of many lives haunted by the tragedy of one family's loss. after a teenage girl on holiday with her parents goes missing from a village in the heart of rural England. The Costa judges described the novel as hypnotic, compelling and original. It certainly had me charmed and gripped from page one.
They gathered at the car park in the hour before dawn and waited to be told what to do. It was cold and there was little conversation. There were questions that weren't being asked. The missing girl's name was Rebecca Shaw. When last seen, she'd been wearing a white hooded top. A mist hung low across the moor and the ground was frozen hard. They were given instructions and then they moved off, their boots crunching on the stiffened ground and their tracks fading behind them as the heather sprang back into shape. She was 5 feet tall, with dark blonde hair. She had been missing for hours. They kept their eyes down and they didn't speak, and they wondered what they might find. The only sounds were footsteps and dogs barking along the road and faintly a helicopter from the reservoirs. The helicopter had been out all night and found nothing, its searchlights skimming across the heather and surging brown streams. Jackson's sheep had taken the fear and had scattered through a broken gate, and he had been up all hours bringing them back. The mountain rescue teams and the cave teams and the police had found nothing, and at midnight a search had been called. It hadn't taken much to raise the volunteers. Half the village was out already, talking about what could have happened. This was no time of year to have gone up on the hill, it was said. Some of the people who come this way don't know how sharply the weather can turn, how quickly darkness falls. Some of them don't seem to know there are places a mobile phone won't work.
Matt Bates narrating Reservoir 13, written by my guest, John McGregor. John McGregor, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
Reservoir 13 starts very much like a conventional crime novel and has the girl's disappearance at the centre of it, but actually it morphs into something very different. How would you describe the novel?
It's a novel about what happens to a community when a tragedy kind of lands in its midst. So it starts off being about the disappearance of the girl, but it actually becomes about how people carry on with their lives after something like that has happened, and the something is never made clear. And it's really for me, it became a book about the passing of time and what the passing of time does to people, to communities, to how we process significant events in our life.
There's a very telling line early on in the book. People just wanted to know, they felt involved, which is very much the feeling of the community wanting to know what the mystery is, but it's also how we feel as readers. You draw us into the community, don't you?
Yeah, that's what happens in the books I enjoy reading, and I think so. It's kind of what I like to try and do when I'm writing, is to try and make the reader feel involved and maybe also feel complicit in a way, engaged. I mean, one of the questions I was dealing with was, because the girl who goes missing and her family, they're not from the village, they're not part of the community. The people who are left behind, they're upset by what's happened, they're kind of traumatized to some extent, but at the same time, they don't know her personally, and so there's no personal grief or loss. And so some of what they're feeling is in a way kind of voyeuristic or at least secondhand. And that mirrors the experience the reader has. And I kind of wanted to provoke the reader into thinking about that and wondering about that. And what does that secondhandness mean? What does that voyeurism mean? And in terms not just of this novel, but of all novels where you're kind of exploring somebody else's tragedy.
Yes, and the constant annual return by the press to the disappearance and the way the missing girl's name changes from Rebecca to Bex to Becky indicates to the reader that actually a private tragedy has become public property.
Yeah, and that's what always happens in these kind of news stories. The person at the centre of it very quickly becomes quite two-dimensional. There's usually only one photograph of them that is used over and over again. The name that the press used might not actually be the name that the family used for that, I mean, particularly when it's a child. And so you get a very kind of flat two-dimensional image of who this person is and what this loss means to the family. And I quite deliberately left Becky very two-dimensional in the novel because of that.
Now, you do drop hints and maybe clues into the plot. I think the very title, Reservoir 13, and the recurrence of the number 13 throughout the book are there to tantalise the reader. Were you tempted at all to go further into the mystery to solve it?
No, I wasn't. And I actually think people have seen more clues in the book than I put there deliberately. I decided very early on, I knew from the outset that this was going to be a book where the mystery wasn't solved. The girl disappears and that's the tragedy, that she's disappeared and that the family don't have any answers and that's their sadness. And I knew from the beginning that's what the book would be about. And I decided quite early on that in order to kind of stay true to that, I had to make sure that I never decided for myself what it is that's happened to Becky. And so every time I kind of found myself speculating about what the outcome might have been, I kind of quite deliberately pulled back and left that as speculation. And throughout the book, there are, you know, people discuss possibilities. You know, I mean, I think the first thing that people assume is that something horrible has happened to her. Some person has done something horrible to her. And that is a reasonable assumption, given the kind of history of these cases. But equally, she could have fallen in a hole. She could have run away. She could have, there are all sorts of things that could have happened. And those are kind of speculated about over the course of the book. But no, I carefully held back from deciding that for myself because I didn't want it to be something that I knew that I was kind of taunting the reader with. I wanted it to be genuinely a known unknown. And the really interesting thing is that, yeah, people have seen more clues than I thought were there. The title of the book isn't supposed to be significant in terms of what's happened to her. But I think people are trained, certainly in fiction and drama, people are trained to expect clues and to expect solutions and to expect to be able to kind of put these things together like a crossword puzzle. But in real life, that is often not the case.
Yes, I suppose it's the reader's expectations rather than you tantalising the reader's expectations. And certainly, actually, the cycle of the seasons, which you chart beautifully in the background, shows that it's a human preoccupation to know what's going on, whereas the animals, the weather, even the minerals just get on with it themselves.
Yeah. And I think that was, I don't know if that was deliberate from the outset, but that kind of became quite a central idea for me, that all of this other life is simply continuing in a kind of unthinking way. You know, all the kind of animal cycles of life and the plants and even to an extent people's working routines. You know, a lot of the jobs that people have in the book are the sorts of jobs where you just have to do the same things every day. Like if you're a dairy farmer, you have to bring the cows back inside and milk them in the evening, no matter what's happened that day. You know, and you have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and milk them again, no matter what a terrible night you had. You know, just people's working lives are almost a kind of extension of the natural rhythms of the world that this community lives in. And there was a sense I was kind of groping towards of trying to use that to contextualize the tragedy that's kind of landed in their laps and the way that they process that within the passing of time.
It's a beautiful evocation of nature and of the Peak District. You're not a local. Did you have to embed yourself in the Peak District to learn the local names for various animals, insects and plants? Or
I mean, not yes and no. I mean, I live in Nottingham, so the Peak District is on my doorstep, as it's on so many people's doorsteps. And if I go walking and cycling, camping, that's where I go. So I know it as a visitor, and I know it reasonably well as a visitor. But I was very conscious when I decided to set the book there that I don't know it as a resident. I don't know it as somebody who works in that landscape. And so I did have to do a lot of research. And I think my first instinct was to try and kind of, yeah, as you say, embed myself and kind of try and arrange, like, I don't know, a month, almost like internships, like a month working with a gamekeeper and a month working with a sheep farmer. And that never really came off. So in the end, I did most of my research through books and online. And at the beginning, I thought, well, that's going to be far too superficial. That's not going to do the job. But actually, it's really interesting. I mean, it sounds glib, but there are a lot of farmers on social media. And actually, by following a whole stack of farmers and gamekeepers and river keepers and whoever else, on Twitter. I got a really nice, quite rich account of people's daily lives and people's vocabulary and people's kind of day-to-day concerns. And that actually built up very quickly into a really kind of valuable body of research. And then what I did was I showed key people the finished manuscript, and they were able to kind of pick out all the stuff that sounded stupid and wrong.
A pale light moved slowly across the moor, catching in the flooded cloughs and ditches and sharpening until the clouds closed overhead. On the riverbank towards the weir at dusk, a heron stood and watched the water. A slow fog came down from the hills overnight. At 4 in the morning, Les Thompson was up and bringing the cows across the yard for milking. Later in the day, the vicar was seen driving to the Hunter place.
It's a very compelling audiobook read by Matt Bates. Did you have any choice as to who your narrator was, and have you listened to it yourself?
I did, actually, yeah. I was certainly consulted. And, yeah, I was quite keen. I think the temptation with a book like this would be for somebody in London to cast somebody with a very, very definitely kind of northern accent and to kind of really go to town on it being a country accent. And actually, for me, it was important that that wasn't the case, that, you know, Derbyshire is a big county, Peak District is a big area with a huge range of people from all sorts of different backgrounds and different contexts and different accents and different voices. And I wanted the voice to be quite low key and not kind of take prominence. And I think he reads it really nicely. I mean, I haven't listened to the whole thing. That would be kind of excruciating for me, I think, the same way I haven't read the whole book since it's published. But yeah, I think he's done a great job. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that you've enjoyed reading the book in that way.
I think it reflects your prose style, which is not flowery at all. It's, I don't want to say matter of fact, because that isn't the right word, but it presents the facts in a clear and undramatic way, and the drama is actually in the questions that surround the disappearance and people's reaction to it, rather than in flashy language.
Yeah, I mean, I think matter of fact is a good description, to be honest. I think that was one of the things I was aiming for, and I was really, I think particularly with any kind of nature writing, any kind of writing about the natural world, there's a real temptation to flower up the language and to kind of really go to town on describing the way things look and the way things are. And what I was finding in the course of my research, actually, the natural world is full of poetry in the sense of just the way things are, you know, and you don't need to kind of flower it up. And I was quite keen to just give, make it matter of fact, kind of present people with the facts of, this is when the blackbirds lay their eggs. This is what they use to make their nests. This is what a fledgling blackbird looks like when it first tries to fly. You know, all of those kind of little, just one sentence details that would build up to create a bigger picture. So yeah, matter of fact was kind of what I was aiming for.
On your website, you say that you're Britain's second best story writer, which I think is a reference to coming second in the BBC short story competition a couple of times.
Prizes are fun when you're part of them. They're more fun when you win them. And they shouldn't be taken too seriously. It's sometimes hard to not take them too seriously. They do a great job of bringing books to the attention of readers. Sometimes they do a great job of bringing books to the attention of readers that otherwise would have been overlooked and are worth, you know, putting in front of readers. Sometimes they get their choices wrong, and the question of what wrong means is completely subjective. Sometimes when you're sort of involved on the fringes of it and you don't get as far as you were hoping to get, it all feels a bit like a kind of beauty pageant. But on the whole, I'd say that if you don't take them too seriously and you enjoy them for what they are, then prizes can be a lot of fun. And it's certainly been hugely pleasing to have won the Novel of the Year award. Obviously, that's a lovely affirmation.
Thank you very much for appearing as a guest on Read On.
Thank you.
Reservoir 13, narrated by Matt Bates, is TB701860. And is also available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB library. Now it's back to Ros Watkins for the books of her life. Ros, was there a book that you read as a child, a very young woman, that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I'm going to go for Black Beauty. I read it when I was very young, but I still remember it. And I actually remember how upsetting I found it, that it really made me think about these poor horses and this bearing rain, and it was just awful. But the effect it had on me, I mean, I got interested in animal rights as a child. I think it was from the books that I read initially, that book. So the power that that book had, and I think it actually did change some of the regulations about the way horses were treated. So just so much respect that she could do that with a book. Very inspiring.
One night, a few days after James had left, I had eaten my hay and was laid down in my straw fast asleep, when I was suddenly awoke by the stable bell ringing very loud. I heard the door of John's house open and his feet running up to the hall. He was back again in no time. He unlocked the stable door and came in, calling out, "Wake up, Beauty! You must go well now, if ever you did." And almost before I could think, he had got the saddle on my back and the bridle on my head. He just ran round for his coat, and then took me at a quick trot up to the hall door. The squire stood there with a lamp in his hand. "Now, John," he said, "ride for your life. That is, for your mistress's life. There's not a moment to lose. Give this note to Dr. White. Give your horse a rest at the inn, and be back as soon as you can." John said, "Yes, sir," and was on my back in a minute. The gardener, who lived at the lodge, had heard the bell ring, and was ready with the gate open, and away we went through the park and through the village, and down the hill till we came to the toll gate. John called very loud and thumped upon the door. The man was soon out and flung open the gate. "Now," said John, "do you keep the gate open for the doctor. Here's the money." And off we went again.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library, including as TB1713, narrated by Elizabeth Proud. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I'm going to go for Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit by Jeanette Winterson, which I just find funny, and I love the writing, and I just feel I could read that one again and again.
Like most people, I lived for a long time with my mother and father. My father liked to watch the wrestling. My mother liked to wrestle. It didn't matter what. She was in the white corner, and that was that. She hung out the largest sheets on the windiest days. She wanted the Mormons to knock at the door. At election time, in a Labour mill town, she put a picture of the Conservative candidate in the window. She had never heard of mixed feelings. There were friends and there were enemies. Enemies were the devil in his many forms, next door, sex in its many forms, slugs. Friends were God, our dog, Auntie Madge, the novels of Charlotte Bronte, slug pellets, and me, at first. I had been brought in to join her in a tag match against the rest of the world. She had a mysterious attitude towards the begetting of children. It wasn't that she couldn't do it, more that she didn't want to do it. She was very bitter about the Virgin Mary getting there first. So she did the next best thing and arranged for a foundling. That was me.
Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit by Jeanette Winterson is available in Braille and as TB6547, narrated by Gretel Davis. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to recommend to the Read On listeners?
It's probably not for everyone, but a book that I've read recently that has made a big impression on me is The World I Fell Out Of by Melanie Reed. She's a journalist for The Times who had a riding accident and broke her neck. And it's about her experiences. And it doesn't sound a very fun read, but she's funny and honest and just incredible, and it kind of made me appreciate what I've got and just thought it was amazing.
For Dave, who came to watch me just once, it was poignant. "It was just like seeing the old you riding at home," was all he said. But if relationships work at their deepest level, it's by generosity and he was delighted to see me so thrilled. Happiness is so often the result of trying to make someone else happy, or at least help them to be happy. Nellie was proving immense therapy. Increasingly, I rode with Sarah merely walking at my left knee. Then came the day she stepped back a few paces, and finally I started to ride independently, just me and the horse, a partnership based on balance and trust. When I got off, soon afterwards, my legs were actually floppy, my stomach muscles no longer in spasm. I was high as a kite, and it was nothing to do with any drugs. I gloried in the motion and the empowerment, steering Nellie around the school, my hands trying to establish a relationship with her mouth, like old times. My hands, funnily enough, were softer, in the horse rider's sense of being sympathetic, than they had been able-bodied. Using a long stick in each hand to touch her sides, replacing the commands from my legs, I was able to persuade Nellie to relax her jaw and perform dressage moves, tight 10-meter circles, changes of rein, semicircles and loops. I built up to a serpentine, a multiple S movement, pretending I was normal, imagining that I was bending Nellie around my inside leg and allowing my outside leg to swing back behind the girth. Maybe, just maybe, the muscles would start to remember. A riding arena is marked with letters. Circle at B. Change the rein, H to F. That alphabet was my release from prison, my weekly 40 minutes of escape. 40, which felt like 5, it went so fast. Me and her, slowly weaving our way around the chill indoor school, my mind wiped clean of anything but my communication with her.
Melanie Reed narrating her memoir, The World I Fell Out Of, which is TB704060. Ros Watkins, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners.
Thanks so much.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.